I got a little bit carried away because I love the Jataka tales so much, and then I got quite excited because I found these books, and also Ratnaprabha alerted me to this Penguin book of Jataka tales, which has got an absolutely fantastic introduction in it. So I'm a little bit worried, so I hope I won't bore you with all I've got to say, because there's quite a bit to say, so it is going to be a slightly longer talk today. But I hope we will have some time at the end for questions, and also for just ending with just sitting, as we usually do. Okay. So let's just start. So, as I said, I am quite excited about to be able to tell you about the Jataka tales. I've loved them for a long time, and I became aware of them actually before I became a Buddhist. It was on my travels around Nepal in the 80s, very long time ago. I lived and worked in Nepal for a few years, and there these stories were very popular, and I heard them there first. And then in Burma, and then later in India. And you can sort of see them as delightful sort of picture stories on all the temple walls. You even get sort of children's picture books with the Jataka tales on them. They're kind of everywhere in traditional Buddhist countries. And I've heard since then from some Indian friends that they're still used as they were in ancient times as one of the main ways of teaching the Dharma, to teach the Buddhist teachings, particularly in villages where people haven't had a formal education. They're still used to illustrate sort of teachings of the Buddha. And they're very effective. Because they're not teaching with abstract concepts, but everyone, you know, whatever their levels of education, can relate to sort of dramatic content and a story with a character. And as I say, you can understand them at so many different levels. So I've since then seen them used in India for teaching, and it's been fascinating, really. And here they're not used so much, but I think they could be used more. Not only with children. Ratnaprabha was telling me that he sometimes uses them with children, and Manju does puppet plays sometimes with children with the Jataka tales. But I think they are also good to use with adults. And they remind me a bit of sort of the fables, you know, Aesop's fables, deceptively simple, but they're full of multi-layered meanings. And like I said at the beginning of the evening, they illustrate kind of the path of the bodhisattva, so somebody who's taken the bodhisattva vow. Bodhisattva means enlightened being. So it's somebody who's kind of gained insight, gained enlightenment, so they could sort of decide, oh, this is it, you know, I don't have to be reborn, I am just now enlightened. But because, out of compassion, that they decide to be reborn again and again into the world to help other beings become enlightened too. And the path of a bodhisattva then is quite a long one, usually, over many lifetimes, and they have to attain what's called the 10 perfections. So I just list the 10 perfections. I won't talk about all of them, but the 10 perfections are, the first one is generosity, which is what we've been trying to sort of get in touch with a little bit in the meditation earlier. Acting ethically, so following the precepts, those precepts that we've been reciting before the meditation, the basic 5 precepts. Renunciation, which I'll say a bit more about later. Wisdom, effort or energy, putting energy into things, patience, truthfulness, resolve, loving kindness, and equanimity. And in a way, like, each of the stories illustrates maybe one particular one of those perfections. I'll just give you some of the traditional images, because the traditional images for some of the perfections are quite fascinating as well, I think, and very interesting. I talked about one of them before the meditation, which is the image for generosity is an overflowing jug. So you can straight away sort of see, you know, that's quite an obvious image, really. And the most well-known and loved Jataka tale that illustrates the perfection of generosity is this one that's depicted here on the shrine of the hare and the moon. So I'll just quickly sort of retell you the story, because it's quite a simple one. So there's a hare, an otter, a jackal and a monkey in this story, and they live peacefully together in the four corners of a field at the side of a forest with a stream running through it. And they meet in the evenings to talk, and the Bodhisattva, who is the hare in this story, he teaches his friends to meditate on full moon nights, and so it's very important to meditate on full moon nights. And then one day, a holy man comes through the field just on the day just before the full moon. So the hare gets quite excited, and he suggests that they should offer him a generous feast because this is very auspicious. So the other three animals are delighted. So the monkey fetches some mangoes from the forest. The jackal sort of cunningly steals some meat from a nearby house. The otter catches some fish. And then the hare suddenly realises, well, what am I going to give? I've got nothing to give. There's just grass in the field. This is not going to be any good to this person. So he spontaneously decides to offer his own body for food. And he sort of joyfully leaps into the cooking fire as they were making this fire, and completely amazed. And then it turns out that the holy man is the king of the gods who has come to test his, you know, what's his level of generosity, and he's completely impressed. So he rescues him from the cooking fire, and he praises his boundless generosity and says that he will make sure that for generations to come, aeons to come, in fact, people and you know will remember this generosity. And then the story says, which I really love, it says, pressing a mountain, he took the essence of mountain and painted the shape of a hare and the moon. It's quite a... And when this story is told, I don't know if any of you have travelled to the southern hemisphere. When you travel to the southern hemisphere of the world, you actually, when it's full moon, you can actually see a shape that looks pretty much like this, that looks like a hare and the moon. So it's quite magical when you tell the story there and you can actually see it on a full moon night. You can see literally the truth of it in a way. Here, it doesn't look so much like a hare when you look at the full moon. And then the image for renunciation is like a man wanting release from prison, which I found quite fascinating too, because renunciation, you know, sometimes you think, oh goodness, it's a bit miserable, you know, it's giving up things that you might want. But there, it's instead looking at renunciation as a kind of, attachments as a trap. And giving these attachments up is like a release from prison, like breaking free from something. So it's a completely opposite way of looking at renunciation. And I'll refer later to a story later in this talk, which mainly illustrates this perfection of renunciation in this sense of a release. And then I'll tell you the story, the images for patience and equanimity, which I also find very interesting. The image for patience is like the earth that receives and endures all that is thrown upon it. And then equanimity is like the earth accepting all that is thrown at it. And I think particularly, you know, in our times, in our world, it's quite evocative images, isn't it, when we think about the pollution we cause to the world, and you can think of the earth as kind of a living being in itself, you know, just taking everything that's thrown at it, accepting everything that's thrown at it. Quite poignant. And the image for resolve, last one I will talk about, is like a mountain that is firm. And so in the story of the hare, you know, that illustrates the perfection of generosity, but also of resolve, of course. You know, he is resolved on offering something, even if it is his own body. And that is why the king of the gods sort of presses the essence of mountain and then draws his shape on the moon, which is quite lovely. So it's said that the first two of these 10 perfections have a particular transforming power, so dana and sila, so that's generosity and acting ethically. And I don't know if any of you have experienced this yourselves, if you've been trying to practice being generous and keeping the precepts, but it does sort of bestow a kind of confidence. It does make you feel better quite naturally. You know, it makes you feel lighter, it makes you feel better. And the Buddha, on the night of his enlightenment, he had a moment of doubt, you know, when he had sort of gained insight, and then he suddenly sort of thought to himself, who do I think I am, you know? And he sort of lost a little bit of confidence. And what he did at that point is he was asking the earth to bear witness to his generosity, you know, sort of remembering that he had been generous, actually, throughout his lives. And he had been trying to practice ethics. And when he remembered that, he then gained the confidence of saying, yes, I have, actually. You know, I've worked very hard and I have deserved this and I can share this. So we can feel sometimes that our lives are meaningful and creative and even beautiful if we're acting with generosity and ethically. And skillful conduct, as it's called in Buddhism, it just means to be able to respond appropriately to the moment and its particular conditions with kindness, which is kind of what I was trying to get at in that meditation earlier. So whatever the situation is, you try and respond with an open heart and with kindness to yourself and to others, not either or. Okay. And yeah, it's quite interesting to test that in your own experience sometimes. I don't know if we'll have time today, but you might want to do that in your meditation when you sometimes just sit and reflect and maybe remember a time when you have acted generously, even in, just in a little way, you know, helped somebody carry their case up the stairs in the tube or something. Recalling that and just remembering, how did that feel when you did that, you know, and you can actually feel like a really relaxed, good feeling in your body as well as feeling good about it in your mind. So you can really test that out in your own experience, even with quite small things, because all of us have been generous at some point. And it's the opposite. When you sort of recall a moment sometimes when you've been mean, you can also sort of feel quite a contraction and, you know, feeling bad about that. So you can literally sort of test this out in your experience. So as I mentioned before the tea break, these stories are quite ancient and some may well be based on sort of pre-Buddhist popular stories, folk stories. Some of them have been dated back as far as the 5th century before the Christian era. And there are 547 of them, which is an astonishing number. And the oldest sections found were written in verse in this sort of simple, quite non-scholarly, but stylistically quite sophisticated language and structure. And they form a separate part of the early Buddhist texts now, but they were originally memorized orally and they were chanted as songs. And apparently some of the stories reappear in different cultures and literatures around the world, which is quite mysterious and sort of not quite known. How did they travel? You know, how did the same motifs, same stories appearing? And apparently some of the stories in the West are to be found in Chaucer and Shakespeare. So, you know, you wonder, how did they come across those stories? I mean, some might have come across with merchants, maybe hearing those stories, but nobody exactly knows how they travelled around the world. And then the last sort of 10 big stories, as they're called, in the series of the Jatakas, they're thought to be the Buddha's most recent 10 lives before he was in the life when he became the Buddha. And each of those is thought to just illustrate one of the perfections each. And interestingly, sort of different schools of Buddhism disagree on which story illustrates which perfection. So it just shows that they're not really separate, these qualities that the Bodhisattva is you know, trying to develop. They're actually all interconnected, and it's quite difficult to, you know, to differentiate this illustrates this illustrates this one. Quite a lot of them illustrate more than one. So before we focus on just one particular story that some of you may well have heard of, that of the Monkey King, I just want to tell you a little bit more about the context of the Jatakas and how they can help us understand the Buddha and his teachings from a particular angle. So I learned that all I'm going to say in this bit of the talk from this quite an excellent introduction in this book, the Penguin Book of the Jatakas, which I really recommend. And it's a relatively recent translation of the selection of the Jatakas by a Buddhist scholar called Sarah Shaw. And as I say, Ratnaprabha alerted me to this. And Sarah Shaw is also the woman who has brought out these two very lovely illustrated books of the 10 big Jataka tales and has taken pictures all around the traditional Buddhist countries of the sort of rock carvings and paintings that she's found on temple walls off the Jataka's. And just some of you might, I don't know, some of you might know Lucy, who comes to this centre sometimes. Lucy, she lives in Hastings. And Sarah Shaw is actually her mother. So Lucy's given permission for me to tell you that. So I was quite proud of Lucy, or Lucy's mother. Anyway, it's quite interesting. So somebody associated with this Sangha. So she's a Buddhist scholar, and she has written the introduction to this book and has brought out these books. What was I going to say? So yes, so the Jatakas are known in all Buddhist traditions, and they describe the Buddha's first insight. So when the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree before he gained enlightenment, the first insight that came to him was he remembered hundreds and thousands of his past lives. So I'll just read you out what the Buddha said about that when he started teaching. So he said, when the mind was thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of defilement, pliant, malleable, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of recollecting my past lives. I recollected my manifold past lives, one birth, two, five, 10, 50, 100, 1,000, 100,000, many eons of cosmic contraction, many eons of cosmic expansion, many eons of cosmic contraction and expansion. There I had such a name, belonged to such a clan, had such an appearance. Such was my food, such was my experience of pleasure and pain, such the end of my life. Passing away from that state, I re-arose there. There too I had such a name, belonged to such a clan, had such an appearance. Such was my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such the end of my life. Passing away from that state, I re-arose here. Thus I remembered my manifold past lives in their modes and details. This was the first knowledge I attained in the first watch of the night. Ignorance was destroyed, knowledge arose. Darkness was destroyed, light arose. As happens in one who is heedful, ardent and resolute. So that's what he said about that. So what made recollecting his past lives so important? So the stories can sort of be seen as kind of an extended metaphor of one of the main Buddhist teachings, which is that there isn't a fixed self. The continuity of each one of our individual kind of streams of consciousness, as you might say, or nuclei of consciousness, sort of continue through time. That's what the Buddhist teaching is. And it also, the stories sort of show in their flow that how we can be reunited as friends and enemies over many lifetimes. There are sort of similar characters who appear in the stories. They're sort of different. You know, the Buddha sometimes is a hare, sometimes is a monkey, sometimes is a person. And similarly, other characters in the stories sort of reappear in their different guises. So it kind of tells you in story form, it sort of teaches about the bonds of karma, the bonds of sort of the experience and how it carries on over lifetimes. The stories sort of express quite a sophisticated understanding of karma, taking into account the many conditioning factors that can that are beyond our control and can lead to us sort of meandering about in the world in different directions. And they stress that our positive intention in whatever situation, that's what counts. It can make a huge difference, whatever situation you're in. If your intention is a good one and is a kind one and is a positive one, then that can have a massive effect on yourself and also on others. And that would be seen in our example story later. So insight, like the moon released from the clouds, as he put it, is revealed to the Buddha by remembering his past lives as he sits under the Bodhi tree. And yet in the stories themselves, it's quite interesting, that teaching was actually not available, because when the Buddha sort of reappeared as a Bodhisattva in those many lives, in that eon where that happened, there was no living Buddha. So the story of the Bodhisattva who goes through all those lives starts with this Bodhisattva meeting the past Buddha, Dipankara, and he has gained enlightenment, he's gained insight in that life, but he says to Dipankara, no, I want to be reborn. I want to be reborn and attain the 10 perfections so that I can help other beings become enlightened. So that's how the story starts. And then he immerses himself over his lifetimes in different worlds, sort of high and low. And apparently the reason for this, you know why he appears as an animal, sometimes he appears as a spirit, sometimes he's a god, sometimes he's a person. One of the reasons that scholars think that is illustrating is he wants to understand that different sufferings of all the different beings, and in order to really understand what's life like for an animal, for different beings, he actually lives as those beings. So by direct experience, he wants to learn about different creatures' suffering so that he can then help them with that suffering. So it's quite interesting. Made me think of the Wheel of Life, which some of you might have heard about. We've been teaching about that a few months back. And in the Wheel of Life, you can see sort of different worlds, different realms. And in each one, there is a Buddha giving those beings in that world exactly what they need. And the way he can do that is, I suppose, because at one time he's experienced that. So he knows exactly what those beings need by sort of empathy. Yeah. So it's sort of quite radical empathy that it illustrates. So he makes mistakes in these stories. He learns from his mistakes. He shows that he's not a perfect god, but a being just like we all are, who's learning, you know, learning from his mistakes. He sometimes fails. And in the process of it, he greatly inspires others. And he comes through particularly at the end of one of the stories. This comes through particularly at the end of one of the stories where the Bodhisattva, like the Buddha in his own life later, is born into a royal family. But he does everything in his power to prevent becoming king. He really doesn't want to become king because he's experienced. I think he remembers that being king is not a good thing because you're bound to do something that really harms other beings and then you get reborn in hell. So he doesn't want that to happen. So he just wants to absolutely prevent, goes into the homeless life, pretends that he's disabled, does anything to avoid that and manages it. And then when his family find out, oh, okay, that is why he's done it, because he wants to sort of not do harm. You know, that's why he doesn't want to become a king. They're so inspired that they all follow lots of people follow his example. His family follows his example. Then people come to visit them wondering what's going on in this kingdom. And they all follow their example. So I just want to just read you a little extract of that, because that's very interesting. Bit of a utopian vision, really. So at the end of this story, when his family have sort of all gone forth into the homeless life and followed the Bodhisattva, it carries on like this. Now a neighbouring king heard that the king of Kashi had become an ascetic, and he decided to seize the city of Varanasi. He entered the city, and seeing it all decorated, he went up into the king's palace and looked at the 7 different kinds of excellent jewels that were there. Thinking that there must be some danger associated with the wealth, he asked some people he saw in the street, he asked them by which gate the king had left. They told him that it had been the eastern gate, so thereupon he left by the same gate and he went down to the banks of the river. Seeing his approach, the Bodhisattva went up to him, sat in the sky and delivered a discourse. The king then went with his retinue to become an ascetic, as did another king in the same way. 3 kingdoms were now abandoned. The elephants became wild forest. They became wild forest elephants. The horses became wild forest horses. The chariots just rotted away in the woods. The coins in the storehouses were treated as sand and scattered, and everyone reached the 8 attainments in meditation. At the end of their lives, they were bound for Brahma heavens, even the animals and the elephants and the horses, their minds calmed in the company of the wise. So I quite love that image of them suddenly everybody abandoning their wealth and thinking this is no good, you know, we're just going to become enlightened instead. It's quite inspiring. So many times the Bodhisattva lived as an animal, sometimes as a god, sometimes a human being, as I said. And the human realm is seen in Buddhism as the meeting ground of the higher and lower worlds. So the human life is seen as the one with the biggest opportunity for spiritual growth. So it's not that it's better than any of the others in any sort of hierarchy way, but it's just that in human life, it's thought that there is an equal mixture of pleasure and pain, and that equal mixture of pleasure and pain motivates us for liberation and makes us curious and makes us want to understand. And then we have this ability as humans to reflect on ourselves, so then we can develop our minds. I think that's all to be said about that. So the Jataka stories can also be understood. They can be understood sort of metaphorically as imaginative descriptions of someone's inner journey of transforming their mind. Or in some traditional cultures, people also take them completely literally. You know, they can be understood as both. And in Indian thought, as I said, I think, in an earlier week, is there isn't such a distinction between historical truth and mythical truth. It's all sort of much more intertwined. And, you know, there's just two sides of coin in a way. So how long? Oh, that's not too bad. So I just wanted to read you, not the whole story, but most of the story of the Monkey King, because I think it's good to just hear one example story. It also gives you a little bit of sense, maybe, of the style of those stories, as well as of the quite delightful content. So I'll just read you an excerpt of that story. The Monkey King story. The Hare and the Moon is very famous as well, but I think the Monkey King is probably one of the most famous ones of the Jatakas. Once upon a time in Varanasi, when Brahmadatta was king, the Bodhisattva took rebirth in the womb of a monkey, and when he reached maturity, was a good height and breadth and had stamina and vigour. He lived in the Himalayan regions with a retinue of 80,000 monkeys. There, upon the banks of the Ganga, there was a mango tree, though some say it was a fig tree, which had branches and forks, gave a deep shade, had thick leaves, and had grown up like a mountain peak. Its sweet fruits, which had a heavenly smell and flavour, were as big as water jars. From one branch the fruits fell to the ground, from another into the water of the Ganga, and from two branches fruits fell into the middle, to the roots of the tree. The Bodhisattva took the troop of monkeys there to eat the fruits and thought, "At some time danger will come to us because the fruit is falling into the water." So I think he was thinking somebody will find it. So at blossom time he got them to eat the flowers or nip them in the bud so that not one fruit, even the size of a chickpea, would be left remaining from the branch over the water. Despite this, one ripe fruit, hidden by an ant's nest, did fall into the water, unseen by the 80,000 monkeys. And the king of Varanasi, who was amusing himself, playing in the water, had nets put upstream and downstream, and the fruit stuck fast to the upstream net. When the king had enjoyed the day of play and it was time to go in the evening, the fisherman drew in the net, saw the fruit, and not recognizing it, showed it to the king. The king asked, "What is this fruit?" "We do not know, sir." "Who will know?" they said. "The forester, sir." He had the forester summoned, and hearing from them that it was a mango, he cut it with a knife, and the foresters had the foresters eat it first, just to make sure it wasn't poisoned, I think. And he ate it afterwards and gave some to his ladies and to his ministers. The taste of the ripe fruit remained, suffusing his entire body. Captivated by desire for the taste, he asked the foresters the location of the tree, and they told him that it was on the banks of the river in the Himalayan region. He had a quantity of boats strung to one another and sailed upstream on the route explained by the foresters. And finally they came there and said, "Sir, this is the tree." And the king stopped the boats, and with a crowd of followers he went on foot. He had a couch arranged at the roots of the tree, ate the ripe fruit, and after enjoying the various excellent flavours, went to sleep. They put a guard in each direction and lit a fire. When they'd fallen asleep, the great being, the Bodhisattva, arrived in the middle of the night with his troop of monkeys. 80,000 monkeys moved from branch to branch and ate the mangoes. the king woke up, and seeing the tribe of monkeys, he roused his men and had them call the archers. Surround these fruit-eating monkeys so that they do not escape and kill them. Tomorrow we'll eat monkey flesh as well as mangoes. So the archers obeyed, surrounded the tree, and stood with their arrows ready. The monkeys saw them, and terrified with a fear of death, as they couldn't escape, they went up to the bodhisattva. They said, "Sir, archers stand surrounding the tree, saying they're going to kill the monkeys who are running away. What are we going to do?" And they stood shaking. And the bodhisattva said, "Don't be afraid, I'll save your lives." So reassuring the tribe of monkeys, he got up into a high branch that was growing straight, and from there he went along a branch that stretched towards the river. From the tip of the branch he leapt a distance of 100 lengths for bow and landed on a bush on the bank of the river. He said, "This will be the spot that is as far as I've reached," and he marked out the space. Then he cut a single cane creeper at the root, stripped it, and said, "This end will be bound to the root, and this will go into the air." He decided upon 2 places, and he didn't take into account the attachment of the creeper to his own waist. So he took the creeper, he tied one end to the fixed tree on the river bank, and the other end to his own waist, and with the speed of a thundercloud, ripped by the wind, he jumped 100 bows' lengths to the spot. So he goes with the creeper. But because he hadn't taken account of the bit that was bound to his waist, he couldn't reach the tree, so he had to grab tight onto a mango branch with both of his hands. And then he gave a sign to the tribe of monkeys, saying, "Quickly, get to safety by treading on my back and climbing down the cane creeper." And the 80,000 monkeys paid homage to the great being, and asking his forgiveness, they went there. So they used him as a bridge, in a way, his body as a bridge. And I won't read the rest out, but one of the monkeys, basically, was an enemy of the bodhisattva. And he appears over and over again in the stories. Devadatta is very jealous of the bodhisattva. And he thinks, "I'll take my opportunity." And he goes to a very high branch of the tree and jumps on his back and breaks his back. So it's said that he broke his heart, and actually the monkey dies in the end. But when the king watched all of this, he woke up because of the noise, and he watched all of this, and he was so inspired by the monkey using himself as a bridge to bring his whole tribe sort of to safety. He said, "We can't kill this monkey. That's amazing." And he brings him down, and he kind of asks him, you know, what was he doing? What was he thinking he was doing there? Why was he doing that? The Monkey King was quite injured, but he was still alive at this time. And he explained to the king that having looked after those he was responsible for and brought them to safety was more important to him than his own comfort and happiness, even his own life. And then the king was greatly inspired by such generosity, and he gave him a royal burial and became a more thoughtful and considerate king as a result. So it's a bit like a fairy tale, isn't it? But quite delightful. And yes, just gives you a kind of flavour of what the stories are like.